Well, I very much appreciate you taking the time.
Happy to do.
I ran across your expository papers when I was a student and very much enjoyed reading them.
Were you a mathematics student? Or?
Yes, I did a PhD in math. I started out in PDEs.
Hmm. Where was that?
University of Texas.
Austin?
Yes, sir.
I visited there many years ago.
Oh, did you?
For about a week.
Okay.
I think I came in April. It was a good time of year. Was it April? Anyway, try to avoid the hot season.
Absolutely.
I'm all right like this, actually. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, my dear.
Two things stood out from the expository papers that stuck with me.
Yeah,
one was your comment about one-handed pottery, that some math results are like one-handed pottery, that it's impressive, but the people who use the pottery don't care.
That's right.
And that's been my experience ever since, that sometimes people appreciate very simple solutions.
That's right. Well, it was my reaction to some of the highly technical things which show you can do something under extremely minimal hypotheses, but then, like, who cares? I mean, sometimes it's important, but a lot of the time it's technical, of interest to the technicians, but not to the general user.
Right. Or at least for a while, then maybe something like that'll lay dormant for decades, and then suddenly...
That's the thing about mathematics, that there are unexpected things, things are forgotten, get useful later on, examined later on, so you never know. It's rash to make any strong forecasts.
Another thing I remember from your papers was the comment that exposition should start from the particular and move to the abstract. And,
I've got strong views on that. I mean, there are too many people, particularly when writing mathematics, write very general theorems, and they are right at the end, they may say a little example or so, as those kind of small things. It should be the other way around. You should start with understanding the interesting examples and build up to explain what the general phenomena are. This way you understand as you progress. You go from initial understanding to more understanding. This is both for expository purposes and also for mathematical purposes. It should always guide you. I mean, I always like to say that, if somebody gives me some general theorem, I say, well, I want an example which is both simple and significant. It's very easy to give simple examples that aren't really very interesting, or interesting examples are very difficult. But a simple, interesting case. If it isn't a simple, interesting case, forget it.
That's how I felt studying PDEs, that we build up these ever more abstract kinds of monotone operators on Banach spaces. And, and once in a while I say, well, what is an example of something that is in one of these categories and not one of these? It seemed like everything's a generalization of the Laplacian, but that's not very helpful.
only elliptic equation. Yes. Yes, I mean, I think that's... I mean, mathematics is... one feature of mathematics is its abstraction. The point is, because it's abstract, it can encompass many things under one heading. We talk about waves. Wave for us is not a water wave, it's an oscillating function, but there are many kinds of waves. So it's a very useful concept to abstract things out. And number is an abstract. Everything is an abstract. Mathematics is built on abstractions. On the other hand, we have to have concrete realizations of them to put them in our brain. Your brain has to operate at two levels. It has to have abstract hierarchies, but it also has to have concrete steps that you can put your feet on. And it is both in your own work and in your exposition, ordinary life. If you lose track, lose sight of one, you forget about the example of simple things. Here is a list of highly technical theorems. You learn these and you'll pass the exams. Okay, you learn them and pass them, but so what? Everything useful in mathematics has been devised for a purpose. Even if you don't know, the guy who did it first, he knew what he was doing. He didn't invent Banach spaces just for Banach spaces. Become famous as a man who called Banach. He had a purpose. He was trying to put together many different kinds of spaces together under one useful heading, focused on the thing that was common to them, and then enabled you to go further forward. But without knowing the examples, the whole thing's pointless. So it's a mistake to sort of focus so much on the techniques without constantly, not only at the beginning, but constantly knowing what the good examples are, where they come from, why they're done. And you know, it has to go hand in hand, the examples and the abstraction. But abstraction is essential. You can't do mathematics without abstracting. I mean, that's the whole point. At some stage we get to the point where, you see common features in all these things. Let's invent the notion of whole group. You know? And then you charge ahead with all the things. But you know what you came from. You have illustrations. You can bring out examples of groups all the way. So you have to have the two things going in common. You can't just do particularity. You can't just pile one theorem on top of another theorem without some kind of attempt to put it together, give it an architecture, structure. Then mathematics is just a collection. Poincaré said, in French, of course, science is no longer not just a collection of facts any more than a house is a collection of bricks. You have to put it together in the right way. Architecture is, it's synonymous with, the computer scientists are all talking about architecture, of course. Mathematics is also architecture. They have great theories. Calculus is a great edifice. Algebra, group theory. But they all grow out of concrete things. But you can't just list 100 different one theorems and say, this is mathematics. That's not mathematics. That's categorization. It's a sort of mathematics is not just a dictionary.
I think someone called it stamp collecting or butterfly collecting.
Exactly. Well, I think it was Rutherford who was very scathing about chemistry. He says there was a Schrodinger equation, everything else cooking.
I think people are more willing to give these motivating examples verbally than in print.
You're quite right, because you see, the point about mathematics, it had a history a bit, particularly in recent times, of people starting to go beyond what they can prove and be a bit woolly, and they get a bad reputation, like the Italian algebraic geometer. So then you're taught not to be rigorous. You go to classes and they say epsilon, do it, and you learn to be very, very rigorous. And then when you learn to be rigorous, you think that your papers have to be ultra-rigorous, because otherwise the guys behind you will find a mistake. And so the need for rigor, it's a bit like the people who are afraid of being sued by the lawyers. If you don't put it down, 100%, somebody will sue you. So it's a bit like when people write a mathematical paper, they're afraid that somebody will write and say, well, you forgot to say, or you left out a hypothesis. So they cover themselves in advance. And by that time, you end up with an unreasonable paper. So people are afraid to... when you talk, this is the day before the internet and all that. Now it's bad. If you talk, suddenly the world hears, and somebody writes to you from Timbuktu saying, you forgot to say that. But in principle, when you talk like this, off the record or on the record, you're allowed to lower your standards of rigor in order to increase the power of explanation. You explain things, hand-waving, using analogies, leaving out technical details, because you want to get the idea across. But people tend to write, particularly in mathematics, particularly in the period of the last few decades, the last century, they became very, very formalistic. Papers were rejected if they weren't tied to it up. People were reacting against the loose talk of the past. And so we went to the other extreme. I would tell you, at least make your introduction readable. At least have the heading look sound and intelligible. If you can't make your introduction readable, nobody will read the paper. And actually, most papers aren't read. No, it's a theorem. I think you can take books out of the library and you'll find you're the only... I think they said that the average number of readers per journal was one. Possibly the author. So,
if you have multiple authors, maybe it's a fraction.
That's right. So I used to complain and object to people. Right, I said to a student, make sure your introduction is understandable by a general mathematician or with broad interest. Don't get involved in the technicalities there. Leave them behind. Say we will deal with these questions later. Make the first introduction Don't just say that X be a space and immediately plugged into the tech, which is what people do. So you're right, people, when they know when they give a lecture, that they have to do it differently. Usually, not always. And then they can use all the tools of hand waving, literally, to get ideas across. And that makes a lecture a different form of medium for instruction from reading. Sometimes people write so well that it's as good as a lecture. Hermann Weyl is my great model. You know, he used to write beautiful literature. And you know, reading is a joy because he put a lot of thought into it and deep ideas. Other people can write the same stuff. And I remember the famous example, Hermann Weyl wrote a book called The Classical Groups. A very famous book. And at the same time, there was also a book appeared by Chevalier called Lie Groups. Chevalier's book is compact. All the theorems are there, very precise, Bourbaki definitions, beautifully documented. If you want to learn about it, you can learn it there. It's all Hermann Weyl's the other way. It's discursive, expansive, it's a bigger book. It tells you much more than you need to know. But it's the sort of book you read 10 times. Chevalier's book you read once. And you know, you go back to these other books, which are they're full of throwaway lines and insights. Which is not directly relevant to a formal argument. It's trying to go from A to B. It's trying to give you a vision, a scene. And so that there are not many people who write like that. Hermann Weyl was an exception. You know, he wrote this beautiful book, Classical Groups. And in the introduction, he explains that, you know, he's German. He's writing in a foreign language, in English. He says, I'm writing in a language, he apologizes, not sung by the gods at my cradle. He couldn't get more poetic than that. Here he is talking in a foreign language. He's using a language, apologizing. Not even sung by that. So I'm a great admirer of his style, both in mathematics and in exposition. And the two things go together. I mean, some kind of are inherently highly technical. They like they you know, they focus, very powerful. If you focus your laser beam down to a small, it has a cutting power that it's scary. But you miss the side views. You know, you have blinkers. So I'm a lazy guy. I don't like to dig too hard. I like to look for the soft patch of grass over there.
But I noticed the contrast recently when I found the old paper by Helmus from the 90s. This has progress in math slowed down.
Yeah, yeah.
And he mentions your index theorem as this pinnacle of chain of abstractions. And I was thinking of comparing that to the supposed proof of the ABC conjecture that people say, well, it's built on all the abstractions, but nobody understands it. And I think the difference is with the index theorem, there's certainly a long chain of abstractions, but they're shared abstractions that people understood them. People didn't just say, "Oh, he's just making up his own things," and nobody understands.
No, well, I think part of the question of evolution problems that kind of have a long evolution history. They come from the past. So the past is part of your common heritage. They generalize classical theorems that are known to everybody, more or less. And they go step by step through motivations which are abstractions which are well understood, what they're for. So of course it's a big pyramid, but it's one where the base is very firmly down, understood, and should be explained in a way which is keeps in focus what your objectives are and the diverse applications that you get. Mathematics do it. One is the abstraction. When you got to the abstraction, the whole point is you let it go down to earth and you say we can apply it here or we can apply it there, either in algebraic geometry or in differential geometry or in physics. So when you get your high tops, you walk along the ridges to the next mountain there and the next mountain there, and then you come down to earth in a different valley. So that, it isn't just going up into the sky, disappearing behind the clouds.
I think the ABC proof is more of a flagpole.
That's when you get to the top of the flagpole, what do you do? Well, like these old hermit saints who sat on top of a pillar, you know. So it's a but of course there are different kinds of mathematics, different kinds of people, and I'm going to talk tomorrow, but I'm a bit worried. I'm not sure the talk I gave, and I just gave a casual. I thought all these young guys should talk. Give them. I didn't want to say do this and do that, because you're an old man, you don't want to tell young guys what to do. They know better than you. But you benefit your experience. You know, this is my experience of life. Nothing, you know, here is a broad problem exposition and psychology, which is not usually talked about so much.
Right.
And so that's what I was going to try and get across. It's kind of, then it'll go down. And I was thinking I was going to talk to a lot of young guys. And I'm quite as young as I thought sometimes. you know, depending on what is the definition of youth. But some of them are young. But I think if you're under 30, you're certainly young. But some people here are over 30.
I was watching a video you did a couple of years ago. We were talking about unifying different physical theories, and you described your own position as being a mystic, hoping
That's
for
right.
a grand synthesis.
Yeah, well, I would say that there are these different schools of thought that I identified as different religions, with a prophet following, and I felt I didn't really belong to any one particular faction, and I wanted to say, well, you know, you search for the truth by many different routes, and mystics, well, there are people who are at the other end, stern atheists who believe in nothing. They say there are different religions and their overlap is zero. The common part is, so therefore there's nothing at the core. Other people say it's the union. So all of them are trying to grasp some vision. That's the mystic. The mystic thinks there's a bit of truth in everybody's spiritual point. And I'm a mystic in that sense. I think every interesting line being pursued in this direction has something to be said for it, and will probably play a role in the emerging picture that comes next.
So maybe it's compact, so you could take a finite subcover of these infinite.
Of course. No, they don't have to be infinitely many of them. I put them into school because you know, there are the string theory, the biggest school, and there are people like Roger Penrose, who had a very big angle, and Alan Connors, and so they all have strong ideas, original, and they attract a certain group of followers who march on. They're not. I'm not including all the cracks. You know, there are people sure. way out or unlikely to be contributing much to the. These are serious people who have serious reasons for believing what they're doing, and there's something in it. And the question is that how. And in fact, it turns out that all these different. I made this talk some years ago, and since then, bridges have been built between all these different rival religions. They sort of found out the unexpected links between them. So that's already a bit of convergence. So I'm hoping that there'll be more convergence or using the best of each side. But I'm always hoping there'll be a new prophet emerging, a new vision, a new Einstein. You know, it'd be sad if we'd seen the last of the vision of prophets. Religions are tending to dry up. The prophets we get now are really rather cranky. but it would be sad if really fundamental new insights were not to come anymore. There's no reason why that should stop, but just because in the beginning of the 21st century it would be ridiculous to say that science stopped here, you know.
Right, as some people thought at the beginning of the 20th century. But all we need to do now is add a few decimal places.
Well,
to
or the next layer, the onion, and all that. I think that's a mistake. I mean, you know, at the end of the 19th century, people said physics is finished. We actually know all the bloody blah, blah. But at the beginning of the 20th century, everything exploded.
Right.
And so, 20th century had been, and we no reason to not expect there to be some further revolutionary ideas emerging any day, any time, from anywhere. Some obscure guy out in northern China, or you know, and so I'm hoping that will still be possible, because it'd be very sad if we sort of just grind slowly to a halt and the chap says, sorry guys, we've got as far as we can get, this is the end of the road, we could done our best to describe the universe, can't do any better. That would be sad. You know, I'm an optimist, I believe in progress and something, new ideas. It's a faith. You know, anything other than, well, anything, I've recently been thinking a bit about the nation of faith. if you're a religious person, as I'm not, you believe God created the universe, that's why it works, and, you know, you're trying to prove, understand God's works. That's the traditional view. I mean, there aren't many scientists who work in that framework. Scientists have their own, or outside the religion, have their own faith. Their faith is that the universe is rational. Leave aside whether God exists or what God is, they're trying to find the laws of nature. Well, why are there laws of nature? Why is there an explanation? Well, that's the article of faith of the scientist. He believes that the world is logical, rational, built on logical principles. Who built it? Why they come from? You can be agnostic. God made it. Nature is God. God. I mean, whatever it is, they believe firmly that there is a fundamental explanation for physical, natural phenomena. And this, it's not rational. All you can say is we believe it in the past. It's been quite useful. Evidence is in our favor. The sun does rise every day, and we have. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, it's an article of faith. And a religious person says, well, okay, because God created the world, that's it. But even the non-religious person has to say, well, the world exists. And the world seems to be built on rational principles. You know, I used to make historical talks. I gave one about Pythagoras. And leaving aside his work on Pythagoras' theorem, which is probably not due to Pythagoras, but he was very influential. And Bertrand Russell made a quote which I like to use. He said, Pythagoras is probably the most influential philosopher who ever existed, because he was the first person. He emphasized two things, Pythagoras: the role of numbers in things like the Pythagorean theorem, 3, 4, 5 triangles, and secondly, the role of numbers in music, musical tones. And he was so struck by this that he believed numbers were the base of the universe. And he was therefore the first person to articulate the view that the universe was rational. And ever since that time, all science is based. Bertrand Russell says, for that reason, he was the most influential scientist of all time, philosopher, because he was the one who first articulated the view that the world is rational, built on arithmetical principles, whatever you like. And that's, I mean,
well, literally rational as far as geometric ratios.
That's right, exactly. And the word rational has this double meaning. So I think Russell would like to make provocative remarks, but somebody else I gave a talk said to me, actually, he sort of don't believe Pythagoras was a real person. You undermine all the things. Like Euclid wasn't really one person, or Homer is one. But I think Pythagoras was a person. I think he was actually quite a political figure already in this place where Syracuse lived, and a leader of a local community. And in fact, I think Plato was much influenced by Pythagoras. Had Pythagoras in mind in his idea of the philosopher king, the man who was knew everything and was the natural leader of his community. Pythagoras was a bit in that mold. So, so far as you can pinpoint the beginning of belief in the rationality of the universe, it's an important point, and we all have that belief. We can't explain it. We can't. Push comes to shove. Why do you believe there are fundamental laws of physics to be discovered? You can't really say we have any reason for believing, except evidence of past successes and all that. But I might stop. We might come against a brick wall, and they might say, well, from here onwards, boys, you're on your own. We're in a desert. There's nothing more to be discovered. And so the argument between the scientists and the religious folk, they both have faith, but in faith, some sense, the faith is the same thing, but they put different headings on it. Right, so how are we doing?
Oh, fine.
Any other questions you want me to...
One other question is sort of off our path so far. What do you think of category theory? And do you think it plays a role in this grand unification?
Well, you see, I'm a conservative in many ways. As you get older, you get more conservative. And I don't believe in things unless I'm convinced of their utility. in the early days, well, like ordinary categories of sort of plain, and that was a very useful language. But it's become now more used more and more as a part of formal mathematics, like algebra. There are things that I'll be starting again.
Back to work, yes.
There are things called categories. There are things called two categories, three categories. Right? We've got a more elaborate structure now. It's not just a category. It's a thing where you build categories on categories. At the beginning, I was very suspicious of it. I'm now partially converted. I think it may be necessary. And just like algebra, algebra was an abstraction. When it first came along, people said, you really need algebra. Then you get into categories. These are all higher levels of abstraction. And I'm prepared to be broad-minded. But I like to be persuaded of their thing by their...